coming to you from sunny Los Angeles, California. This is 30 Minute Mentors. Leaders to listen to with Adam Mendler. Here is your host, Adam Mendler.
There is only one person in the history of basketball to lead the NBA, ABA, and NCAA in scoring. Rick Barry is an eight-time NBA All-Star, an NBA Finals MVP, an NBA Hall of Famer, and a member of the NBA's official list of the 50 greatest to ever play the game. Younger basketball fans may know Rick as the father of three NBA players, and believe it or not, all five of Rick's sons played professionally. Rick, thank you for joining us.
Happy to do that, but everybody seems to always forget that I also had 4 years in the ABA where I was an all-star as well, so people tend to forget about that, but that's not a big deal. It's all in the past anyway, and actually, if you want to count the fact that my son is on the Minnesota Timberwolves G League team, hopefully he's going to get a chance to play in the NBA. We'll see what happens, but yeah, it's pretty remarkable when you think about it. I was hoping one of my boys would be good enough to play basketball and go on and go to college, but all five of them got Division I college scholarships. All five have played professionally, three in the NBA. My other son, Scooter, was the last cut by the Celtics. Timing's everything in life, Adam, as you well know.
Sure.
And unfortunately, when he came out, there was only 12-man rosters in the NBA. Now they have 15 with two guys that are two-way guys with the G League. And my son was cut by the Boston Celtics because they had 13 no-cut contracts. And Larry Bird and Kevin McHale both told me, Rick, your son should have been on our team. He was better than our number one draft pick. But wow, he had a nice career overseas, played till he was 40 years old. And so the odds on having that happen with all of your children is probably pretty remarkable. It's probably a Guinness record, I would think.
Yeah, Rick, a little bit later on in the interview, I'm going to dive into that because one of the things I really want to better understand is what are some of the lessons that you taught your kids that helped them along the way? But before we dive into your journey and some of the advice that you have for listeners, a couple of really quick basketball questions. What's your all-time starting five?
Well, I'm going to play the small forward position. And then I'm going to take Wilt Chamberlain as my center. Bill Russell as my power forward, because I don't need Bill Russell to score a point, just rebound and block shots and control the defensive boards along with Wilt. And I defy anybody to go in there and get these crazy kind of dunks that you see all these players getting nowadays. With those two guys in there, that would change dramatically. And then I would have to go with Michael Jordan as the two. And the hardest one is there are a lot of great point guards out there who I really respect, would love to play with, but it's pretty hard not to go. As much as I love Oscar and as amazing as Oscar Robertson was, I like to run. And I like to get up and down the court and play super fast break basketball. And who better to do that than Magic Johnson, who has the versatility also to do other things. So I'd have to go with Magic. So that would be the four guys that I would have. Magic, Michael, Bill, and Wilt.
Rick, a lot of our listeners are probably going to take whatever device they're listening to this on and throw it against the wall because you didn't mention LeBron.
Well, I'm playing the three. I mean, I'm not going to, you know, I'd be more than happy to play against LeBron. I mean, he can play three on their team, but I'm playing three on my team. And I'll take my four guys and you can get any other four guys that they want. And I'd be more than happy to have a matchup with them if it could ever be arranged. Maybe we can do that up in heaven or something. And everybody will be healthy at their prime and we could see what happened. But that's what makes sports interesting, is that you could always have discussions like this and everybody is entitled to their opinions. And certainly to me, though, if I was going to pick somebody to put there at that position and I wasn't playing, I would pick LeBron over Bird, mainly because of the fact that he's just so gifted athletically and can do so many things. And, you know, as great as a player as Bird was, you know, I just give a little bit of an edge to LeBron because of his physical stature. I mean, the guy he was a man child coming out of high school and he's just a beast. There's never been anybody quite like him.
So, I mean, clearly one of the things that fans struggle with and try to do is compare players across generations. And it's really hard for us. You have a much easier time doing it because you've been a part of the NBA since the 1960s as a player, as a coach, as a commentator, as a parent. How do you really go through that exercise and how do players today match up relative to players from other eras?
Well, I think that most people have no idea about guys like Wilt Chamberlain and, you know, Wilt Chamberlain and Bill Russell and the way that they played the game. And, you know, Jerry West, of course, before Michael came along, Oscar Robertson. There's just so many great players that I had the good fortune of playing either with in all-star games or against them. My old teammate, Nate Thurman, playing today would be a dominant big guy. Now the game has changed. The 3-point shot has changed. I mean, you have 7-footers now. These guys are out there shooting 3-point shots, for heaven's sake. I mean, the Greek freak, you know, Giannis was out there, what, made 5 for 8 in a game the other day. Sure. I mean, it's just, and this, it's crazy what these guys are doing, these big people. And it's almost as if the Wilt Chamberlains and the Bill Russells of the world are almost becoming like dinosaurs and becoming extinct. They don't play inside anymore, and they just don't go that route. But I still think there's a place for a player like that, that you can go inside out. And then certainly if a player has the ability to also do some scoring outside, it just gives you even more versatility and much more difficult to defend a team like that. But for anybody, for those who are listening and don't know about it, let me just throw a couple of things out there for you for Wilt Chamberlain. As great as Kareem was, the single greatest shot, I don't always agree with Stephen A. Smith, but Stephen A. Smith the other day, I happened to hear say something, the greatest single shot that anybody's ever had was Kareem's skyhook. And I've been saying that for years. There's never been a more unstoppable, incredible shot than the skyhook of Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. However, Kareem was not, in my opinion, a greater player all around than Wilt Chamberlain. When I start talking about players, I'm not talking about them as far as helping their team win championships. Bill Russell obviously has the title for that. But I'm talking about the skills required to play that position and the things that they did during their career. No one holds a candle to what Wilt Chamberlain has done, and no one will ever compared to what Wilt Chamberlain has done. 50 points a game in one season. Do you understand how incredible that is? It is beyond comprehension to me to think that in my best year playing, I would have had to find a way to get 13 more points in every game that I played it. A lot of guys don't even score 13 as an average in their career, let alone getting 13 more in the game over and above the points I had already scored. And then you look at his rebounding totals. 22.5 rebounds average per game for his career. I mean, that's unheard of. So the things that they did, and they didn't keep block shots back then. I mean, if they had kept block shots and number of shots altered by their defense, that would be another amazing statistic that they would have. They probably would far outshine anything that exists today in the records that they have. So again, a different time and a different era. And then people say to me, well, you know, you guys really couldn't play with these guys today. And I look at them, I said, are you really serious making a statement like that? Do you understand how much better I would be and all of my contemporaries and the guys I played with be if we played today because of the sophistication of the training that is available? We didn't have an agility coach, a strength coach, a dietitian, all of these things that these guys have to make them, I mean, I would be faster, stronger, quicker, jump higher, have more stamina. I mean, it's unbelievable how much better I would be if I was playing today than I was when I played then. So putting all these factors together, the guys back in the day when I played were unbelievably great players. And one of the big differentiations is all of those guys actually knew how to play the game the right way.
So for listeners who are not aware, Rick is known as one of the fiercest competitors in NBA history. Just from the first couple of minutes of this conversation, you can probably tell. Rick, can competitiveness, work ethic, and drive be taught, or is it something innate?
I think it could be influenced some. My father was a perfectionist, and my father was a semi-pro player and coach, and I had the good fortune of him teaching me the game the correct way, which is the fundamentals. I don't care what profession you are in. You must learn the fundamental principles and concepts of that profession in order to give yourself a foundation to build on, because you cannot put a tall building on a small foundation. So you'll never maximize the God-given talents, abilities you have, or the skills that you may learn and work on to develop. You'll never really fully utilize them properly if you don't have that foundation to build on. And that's one of the problems that exists today in all sports, is that in so many of the sports, the fundamentals are not being taught as well as they should be to young kids, and therefore develop a lot of bad habits, and a lot of guys make it all the way to the NBA on amazing athleticism, but they'll never be as good as they should be because they don't understand how to use those amazing skills to their best advantage.
What are some of the things that you did as a player to try to elevate the performance of your teammates?
I just played the game the way it was meant to be played, which is to play aggressively and try to create opportunities offensively. And if somebody was open, I make sure I get the ball to them. And so by doing that and being attacking type of an offensive player, you're going to force the defense to have to do things and try to help. And when they did that, I give the ball to my teammate to create a nice opportunity for him. So you have to play unselfishly. And I always was going to, I'm going to take a shot if I can get open, provided I don't have a teammate in a better position. And also, if he can shoot the ball. I mean, this thing, I'm on TV. I always laugh all the time when I hear, oh, that's a great, you know, making the extra pass. That was awesome. Well, the extra pass is not a good pass. If you're open at 18 feet and your teammate's open at 15 and you pass it to him because he's more wide open, but he can't shoot as well from 15 as you can from 18. It's not about throwing to the open man. It's about throwing it to the guy who has the best chance of scoring. And if you can shoot better than he can, that's not the right pass to make. You always give it to the guy under the basket. But if it's throwing it out to the perimeter and you had a chance to shoot it and you're a better shooter than your teammate, you don't make that pass.
Rick, you were the star player of the teams that you played for much of your career. But who were some of the teammates that you played with who really stood out that contributed in a way that maybe got underappreciated? And what can listeners learn more globally from that example?
They all contributed. It's a team game. It's not about an individual. You don't win a championship if you don't have teammates that perform. So if all of my teammates didn't perform at a high level, we'd never have won a championship in 1975. I mean, in fact, I tell the story all the time that if it weren't for my teammates, we would have never gotten to the finals. Game 7, Western Conference Finals against the Bulls. I was horrible in the first 3.5 quarters of that game. I was something like 2-for-14. And Al Addles had the good fortune. In fact, I was just at a function for a gala for the ACE Foundation that he has in the Oakland area to raise some money. And I got up and had to say a few things. And one of the things I said was the greatest coaching move of Al Addles' career was benching me in this game 7 against Chicago in the third quarter. And midway through it, he took me out of the game. And my teammates held Chicago scoreless for like 7.5 minutes. He kept me out of the game the rest of that quarter, all the way into the fourth quarter. I kind of wanted to go in at the end of the third, but he's the coach. And when I did go in, I fortunately for me was, you know, I can remember the shot that I took and made when I first got back into the game, but also played really well the way I should have been playing the whole game. In the last 6-7 minutes of that quarter, we wound up winning that game and winning the Western Conference and going on to pull off the biggest upset in the history of the NBA Finals by sweeping the Bullets. And but if it wasn't for my teammates, we don't get there. Now, some of them obviously better. Probably the greatest player I played with in my career on my team was Nate Thurman, who's a top 50 player, one of the greatest centers of all time. But I also had other players who were outstanding. Oh, Jeff Mullins and Derek Dickey and Butch Beard and Charles Johnson and Charles Dudley, George Johnson. You just go on. Clifford Ray was like my dearest friend ever, but Clifford probably was more important to our team than I was from the standpoint of bringing everybody together and making us a cohesive unit and making us the team that we were, where we really cared about winning and not necessarily about individual awards and honors. And Clifford was, I say Clifford was the hub, and I was one of the important spokes along with my teammates, but Clifford was the most important player on our team as far as I'm concerned.
Rick, how important do you believe coaches are to a team's win-loss record, and what are the defining characteristics of a great coach?
Well, I think, first of all, a coach has to earn the respect of his star players. Because if you don't get the star players to go buy into what you're trying to accomplish with the team, you have no chance of success. And so that's the number one element. And the other important element to me is that you can't have such an ego that you're going to make the team play the way you want them to play in a style that you want to have employed. You have to put in an offensive system and a defensive system that caters to the talent of your personnel. It'd be like somebody to do something in a business to take a guy who's unbelievable in research and put him in sales. Makes no sense, right? Same thing here. You can't take guys and try to force them to play the way that you want them to play when they don't have the talent to play that way. So you have to be willing to change and implement it and find out what their strengths and weaknesses are and to utilize those strengths as often as possible and in the best way possible and minimize putting them in situations where their weaknesses can be exploited. And also, one last thing on that.
Sure.
Coaches get too much credit a lot of times, but more often than not, they get too much blame. Because most coaches don't have the authority to choose the players they want to coach. And so they have to try to make sometimes chicken salad out of you-know-what given to them by general managers.
Sure. Could totally agree. Rick, what coach in today's game do you admire most and why?
Well, you have to admire the guys who have had success for extended periods of time. Obviously, Greg Popovich, you know, pops in, the guy who's still current and still active, although even showing now he doesn't have the personnel. You know, they're not doing very well. They're not having a real good season this year. The greatest coach in the world can't win if he doesn't have the right talent. The game and team sports in any sport comes down to 3 major criteria. Without these, you can't be successful. Who do you draft? Who do you get in free agency? Who do you trade for? It's all about the players that you choose. And then you hope that you get a coach that doesn't screw that up if you make the right choices. And so to know how good a coach is, though, you really can't make a true evaluation unless you play for him. Because if you're not in the huddles, if you're not at the practices, and you don't really hear what's being said and what's being asked of you and what adjustments are being made, because even though you see a timeout, it used to be that after the 75 finals, actually, TV started, they took the huddles. The coaches didn't want to have the microphones in the huddles anymore because Casey Jones actually lost his job over what happened in the finals when Bernie Bickerstaff, his assistant coach, seemed to be coaching the team. And there was the huge upset and he lost his job and the coaches voted to not have mics in the huddle. Now they got that back again because it really can show you just how good a coach is, the way he comports himself, the things that he says to his teams. And so it can be very telling. But even then, before they had that, you can hear what he's saying to his team. You don't know. And the announcers would say, well, that's not a very good play. Well, it may not be the play that the coach just told the players to run. He may have told them one thing and they went out there and did something else. And everybody's blaming the coach for the lousy play that was run when the players themselves went out there and didn't do what the coach asked them to do. So it's very difficult.
Experience Adam's insights and inspirational message by booking Adam to appear at your company, on your campus, or at your next event. Adam's keynotes and workshops on leading in today's landscape, becoming your best self, and lessons learned from America's top leaders leave audiences inspired and better equipped to excel personally and professionally. Visit adammendler.com to learn more and to bring Adam to your organization.
You mentioned the importance of a coach winning over star players. How does a coach win over star players? How does a coach win over the locker room?
We'll just develop a relationship with them. The first thing I would do if I ever did get to coach, I even did it on the minor league level, is you take those players out and you go out to have dinner with them or lunch with them and you spend some time with them and get to know them as people and then explain to them what you're attempting to do with the team and try to basically become a salesman and sell them on what you would want that, what you want to happen and what you want to employ with this team and have them buy into that. Because if they don't buy into it, it's not going to work. Very simple.
Very applicable advice, whether you're a coach in the NBA or whether you're a leader of any kind of organization. So, Rick,
well, that's that. I tell when I talk to businesses, the similarities between sports and business are so similar and are applicable in both. I mean, it really truly is. I mean, you get down to the same situation. A boss is required to analyze his personnel and put those personnel in the right situation to be able to maximize the potential that he has. And a lot of times they don't do that and they don't utilize their people properly. And a lot of times they have a business that's set up to operate in a certain manner that which may not be the best way to operate your business depending upon your personnel. And you have to be willing to change. And that's what coaches have to be willing to do. And a lot of them don't do it. In football, most of the time they draft according to what their needs are. They have their system. They try to get players who play and have the skills to fill in to play in that system. And so in basketball, it's not that easy. I mean, you can't necessarily find, because you don't have that many players, you can't necessarily find someone who might have the skills to play in your system. And so you wind up drafting somebody who has this talent and ability and stuff, but he's not good for your system. And then you try to force him to play your way and it doesn't work out.
Rick, what are the biggest misconceptions that people have about success?
That it comes easy, that you'd be just be in the right place at the right time. That has a lot to do with it. You have to be in the right place at the right time, but it all comes down to you and your preparation. It doesn't just happen by happenstance. I mean, if you understand it, some of the most successful people, you know, failed a lot of times along the way and you learn by your mistakes. Intelligent people learn by their mistakes. Like somebody once said, I've never seen a name associated with the quote that I saw, that the fastest way to learn to do something right is to do it wrong.
Sure.
But the thing is the smart person learns from that mistake and you just don't make the same mistakes over and over again. You avoid making a mistake that you are become aware of and avoid that like the plague and try to make yourself better through the learning experience that you had by having made that mistake. And it's just a matter of putting the time and the effort in. And here's the thing, it's that you have to work at it. Well, I don't like that word work, because if you love what you're doing, that's one of the keys to success. Find something you love and have a passion for. Otherwise, you got a job. Felt like I had a job playing basketball. It was never a job. I got paid.
What advice do you give people on how to discover their passion?
If you love what you're doing, and it's not like you say, oh, I got to go to work today, or I got to go do this. No, it's something that you love to do that really gets you excited. And if you find that, whatever field of endeavor it happens to be in, as I say, learn as much about it as you can, get the fundamentals down, put that huge foundation down, keep learning, never be satisfied that you got to the point that you've got it now and you're successful. You could always improve and get better. And if you do that, then you have a fighting chance, but you also now have a situation where I tell kids, it's one of the big number of things that I talk to them about. I try to give them some good advice. I said, if there's nothing else that you get out of what I'm telling here today, the one thing I'm going to tell you is that find something you love and have a passion for and learn as much about it as you can, because then you'll never work for a living. I said, think about it. I love basketball. I applied myself to basketball. Someone paid me. I got paid to do what I love to do. That's not work.
I love that, Rick. In your career, you played in a lot of high pressure moments. How did
I'm going to stop you there. Okay. Excuse me. I have to stop you.
Yeah.
Pressure does not exist. I hear this word so often, especially in the sports world. Pressure does not exist in the real world unless you allow it to exist. What you are called upon to do in life, in certain situations, it's a critical situation. You may have to go and make a presentation for a multi-million dollar deal and for your business. You have the ball in your hands with 5 seconds or 10 seconds on the clock and you're trailing by one. I mean, those are situations that are critical situations where pressure can become a factor, but only if you lack confidence in your ability to do what it is that you've trained to do. So if you've trained properly, and that's to me the key to success, is confidence in your ability to perform at what it is you've trained to do. And if you have that confidence, you will never feel pressure. I never in my entire life felt pressure in a basketball game. In fact, if I could have it, perfect world, I would hope that every game I played in would have come down to the last 10 seconds with the ball in my hand.
What percentage of the NBA do you think feels that way?
Not that many.
Interesting. Yeah.
And doing the broadcasting work and having played, I saw some guys that the last thing they'd ever won is the ball in their hands in those situations. But the great ones probably felt that way. But I even hear great ones talking about, the pressure was tough and all. No, if you really analyze it and truly, and I'm saying this from firsthand experience, I know what it's like to feel pressure in sports because it happened to me in my life one time that I said, I'm never going to let this happen again where I'm not prepared to do what I'm supposed to be doing. It's the worst feeling in the world and you'll choke like a dog.
What was the biggest risk you ever took in your career?
Well, the biggest risk I took was leaving to go to the ABA, probably. I mean, that is a big risk. I mean, and it didn't work out to be the greatest at all because the league was terrible. And I wound up getting hurt when I went over there. And if I'd stayed in the NBA and, you know, I mean, I was an all-pro player in my rookie year, which rarely ever happens along with everybody. You say, he was rookie of the year. Well, big deal. I was rookie of the year. No, I was all-pro first team as a rookie. That's a big deal. And I led the league in scoring and first team all pro again in my second year. And I left. I mean, so if I had stayed and probably gave up one of the best years of my career that I would have had if had I played that year and stayed in the NBA, my stature in the game of basketball would be so much greater than what it is right now because people got all upset with me in the NBA because I wound up leaving. It actually changed the whole thing. I was Kurt Flood before Kurt Flood opened up the doors for free agency for guys to go ahead and get bigger contracts and change teams. It was a revolutionary thing. And so that was a risk on my part to do it. But everything in life happens for a reason. And so if that hadn't taken place and my journey in life hadn't gone through where it went through, I wouldn't have the same friends I have today. And I wouldn't have the wife and the incredible younger son that I have. You see, he's 25. He's not so young anymore. But I wouldn't have that in my life because everything does happen in life for a reason. And you can't worry about things that don't work out for you. Hey, I tell people, look, if you have something happen in your life that's really sad, cry. Get over it and move on because you're not going to change what happened. Sit around feeling sorry for yourself is not going to do you any good.
I couldn't agree with you more. What is your philosophy on how to develop a winning mindset?
Preparation. You know, learn about what it is. You know, then get confidence. Learn it. Do it over and over and over again. Make sure you're doing it the proper way. Get really proficient at it to the point where you believe that you could be successful. Was I always successful? Heck no. I missed a lot of last second shots and made some plays that didn't work out well, but I thought I was going to do the right thing. I believed in myself. And if you get to that point, then you've got a strong will and you've got a strong determination and you have great confidence in your abilities. And that's what you want to have. And that'll help you to get through a lot of difficult situations and just be prepared that you're going to fail sometimes. You're a human being. There was only one perfect human being and he got nailed to a cross.
How did you motivate yourself on the days you didn't feel motivated? And how did you try to motivate your teammates on the days that they didn't feel motivated?
Well, here's the thing. First of all, if you know what you're doing as a general manager and you're a coach, the coach shouldn't have to worry about motivating his players. You should pick players that are self-motivators. That's what I look for. If you got to motivate your guy, he's not the guy you want on your team. Seriously. If you have to motivate a player that you're paying money to, especially on the pro level, you got to motivate him? You made the wrong choice.
What about on a down day? I mean, you know, some days you...
Well, you just encourage a guy. You just encourage him. And just, you know, I mean, certainly guys are going through some tough times. I think that in today's world, in the old days, coaches would yell and scream and holler at you. I don't think players today relate well to that. I think you just need to be honest with your players. You need to communicate with them. You need to let them know that you have their best interest at heart. But I always tell my players when I did coach in the minor leagues, look, I'm being selfish in this point. I said, you can't be selfish as a player, but I'm being selfish as a coach. And here's why I'm being selfish. Because I'm selfish because I'm going to try to tell you everything that's the best thing to do to help this team. And it may not be something that you think's in your best interest. I said, but trust me, it really is in your best interest, but it's more so in the interest of the team. And if you do that, you'll be rewarded for it. And to stand behind it and be a man of your word and treat everybody fairly.
Rick, what are the best lessons that you instilled in your sons over the years that you believe allowed each of them to play at such a high level?
Well, first of all, I do what my dad did to me is I gave them the foundation to build on, the fundamentals. So they had that. And then it was really up to them how much effort they wanted to put forth. But I also instilled the one other thing that my father instilled in me, which I think is a critical thing. And that is to always take great pride in what you do and always give your best effort in everything that you do in life. And again, not being afraid to fail and learn through your mistakes. But I think that's the key to it is always give your best effort, no matter what it is that you're doing. And then at least you can feel good about yourself at that night and go to bed and sleep peacefully. Now, you probably wouldn't sleep that peacefully because you're going to be upset about the fact that you may have lost and you made a mistake and that'll keep you awake for a while. But at least you know you tried your best. But man, to go out and do something and know that you didn't try your best and then you failed at it, how do you live with yourself if you're that type of a person? I don't want that kind of person as my teammate, I can tell you that.
Rick, for all of your accolades, many casual fans know you as the guy who shot free throws underhanded. I'm sure you hear that a lot. For listeners who are not aware, Rick was the number one free throw shooter in NBA history when he retired. Rick is a strong advocate of others adopting his technique. How did you start shooting underhanded? And did you ever feel embarrassed or afraid of doing something different that could potentially make you the subject of mockery?
Well, I didn't want to do it to start with because my dad said I should try it and I could be a better free throw shooter because I was like mid-70s. And so back then, girls did it that way. So I said, I can't do that. Everybody's going to make fun of me. And I remember, like he said it yesterday, son, they can't make fun of you if you're making them. And that's exactly what happened. So I tried it just to get him off my back. I really didn't want to do it. But as I tried it and I gave a sincere effort doing it, I said, wow, this is actually pretty darn good. And so I worked on it that summer. And then that next season in high school, I don't know where it was before junior or senior year, I shot over 80% for the first time. And I just kept getting better and better. And I remember the first time I shot, it happened to be an away game. And one of the fans was yelling, hey, Barry, you big sissy, shoot like that. And I heard so perfectly clear from the guy sitting next to him, what are you making fun of him for? He doesn't miss. And from that point on, I was cool. Never bothered me at all because isn't the object is to shoot the highest percentage possible. What difference does it make what form you use? The result is what matters. And I had the result.
Rick, that's a great story. What is your best advice on how to get out of your comfort zone? Because clearly there are a lot of NBA players and who are not adopting your technique because they're afraid of getting out of their comfort zone. And there are a lot of people who are not doing things that they could be doing to become better in whatever it is that they're doing professionally because they're afraid of getting embarrassed or mocked or whatever it is. What is your advice on how listeners can get out of their comfort zone?
Well, I can't tell it. I mean, everybody is a different individual. So, I mean, anything that I say wouldn't be any helpful to them because I just did what I did. I mean, my whole thing is I wanted to be perfect. And as I say, nobody, only one perfect person. I already told you that. I just never was satisfied with what I was doing. And I was always looking, and same thing in golf. I changed my putting stroke. Somebody showed me a new putter to do something that made all the sense in the world. And I changed it. You should always be willing to listen to advice and listen to things that could help you to improve in what it is and become more successful at what you're doing. And so you should always have an open mind to that. And again, just get to the point where I don't care what somebody else thinks about me. It's a matter of whether or not I'm happy with what I'm doing. And I was perfectly happy with what I was doing because what I was doing with free throws was better than 98% of the people doing it. And actually more than 100%, at a long point, it was more better than 100% of the people who were doing it. So anyway, it's just a personal thing. So I really can't tell you I have an answer. If I had an answer to that, I could probably market it and become a millionaire.
Rick, final question, and one that I know is relevant to a lot of listeners. What are your best tips on how to improve your jump shot?
Same thing. Just learn the fundamentals. I mean, everything comes down to the fundamentals and then repeating it over and over again, but repeating it in a way that you're doing the fundamentals properly. The easiest thing in the world to do in life is to develop a bad habit. One of the most difficult things to do is to break that bad habit. And so that's why I get back to what we initially talked about. You must learn the fundamental principles and concept of what it is that you're doing. And in basketball, there are a number of things, the proper fundamentals in shooting the ball. And so if you learn the proper fundamentals in shooting the basketball and go out and practice them over and over again, you'll get more proficient at it, you'll get more confident in it, and you'll be successful at it. But if you don't know the fundamentals and you go out and start shooting and you get all these bad habits, LeBron James is a perfect example of that. LeBron came into the NBA from high school with horrible shooting form. And it took years before he ever changed it. And it didn't happen until after I made a big deal about it when I was doing stuff in the Bay Area when they came to play the Warriors one of the series that they played. And I said, LeBron James will never be a good shooter. He has horrible shooting form. He's got a flying elbow. You can't be a good shooter with a flying elbow. They said, are you criticizing the coaching staff of the Cleveland Cavaliers? I said, hell yeah, I am. I said, because, I mean, for this guy, the great talent that he is, to have such poor shooting form, and he's been in the league for 3 years and nobody's got him to change it. What are they doing? What are they getting paid for? And if you walk in, you just go look at some footage of LeBron in his first 3 years playing and see where his elbow is and see where it is now. He's a far better shooter now than he ever was. He's still not where he needs to be. He's never been an 80% free throw shooter, which to me is the point. If you can't shoot 80% from the free throw line, you can't call yourself a good free throw shooter. And LeBron's never shot that. And I saw a statistic the other day. He's missed the second most number of clutch free throws over the last 10 years in the history in the NBA for the players in the league the last 10 years. The only guy worse than him in missing free throws in clutch situations is Dwight Howard, who's now his teammate. And the two of them each missed two of them in a game the other day against Milwaukee and lost. So that's what it comes down to. I mean, you have to learn the fundamental principles and concepts of what it is, then go out and practice it over and over and over again till you get it to the point where you have great confidence in it and you're going to get better doing it if you have the proper fundamentals.
Growing up, Rick, I remember you were a staunch advocate for Shaq shooting underhanded free throws. Maybe LeBron will heed your advice.
No, LeBron wouldn't shoot. LeBron's, right, he's up in the 75 range. He's gotten better. He just needs to have refined it. I mean, the problem is that somebody wasn't working with him enough to get it to that point. And I honestly do believe that mentally, I don't think he really likes going to the free throw line late in games. When I drove, I wanted to get fouled, knowing that I'm going to make some baskets and now I got 3 points instead of two. And if I didn't make the basket, I'm going to make two. I don't think LeBron has that mindset. I don't think he has that confidence that we talked about. And then, Shaq's career would have changed if he would have lived it. But he just said he was a hip hop kind of guy. And he said, it would ruin his image. Well, the problem is it cost him championships. There's no doubt about it. Shaquille O'Neal shooting 80% from the free throw line when in his career, at the end of a game, basically, you would have no chance of beating the Lakers because all you do is throw it to him in the post and the game is over.
Yeah, I remember those days very well, like they were yesterday. So, Rick, before you go, tell our listeners about your new podcast.
Yes, it's Warriors 24. I'm doing it with Cyrus Sachs, who was a producer of mine when I did sports radio for KNBR in San Francisco. Warriors 24. We talk about the Warriors, but we actually get into a lot of stuff in the NBA because the Warriors, there's not a lot to talk about them right now. A team that went from the penthouse to the outhouse, and they're struggling mightily. And so tune in. You can check it out. You can go to Apple Podcast and put Warriors 24 in there and find it. So hopefully you'll enjoy it. Have a lot of fun doing it. And I've always liked talking about the game that I love so much.
Rick, thank you for joining us. It was a pleasure. Appreciate your advice. Appreciate everything you shared. And thank you for being a part of the show.
Well, happy to join you and God bless you and your listeners.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to 30 Minute Mentors. If you enjoyed the podcast, spread the word and feel free to tag Adam at Adam Mendler. You can also head to adammendler.com for more episodes and to subscribe, rate, and leave a review. And don't forget to join us next week for another episode with another one of our 30-Minute Mentors.